So a few months ago, I was walking back to my home in Boston from the bus stop, and as I was walking up the sidewalk, I noticed I was partially zoning out and partially registering around me, middle of the day. I noticed that somebody seemed to be saying something to me, and I just kept walking, not really consciously ignoring them, but filing it somewhere under, you know, maybe possibly unwanted attention from a male-bodied person, not worth engaging, filing it under that folder. It wasn't until I was a full 5 seconds past this person that I registered that they had put their hand up for a high five as they walked past me. That's weird, a high five on the city street, not so usual. I turned around and I saw my housemate walking away toward the bus stop, a little dejected. I called after him and we connected and had a moment of laughter about me passing him on the street and not registering it. But I had registered it. I had registered it as a possible catcall, unwanted attention directed towards women's bodies in public. And I had passively dealt with it as such, just ignoring it and not really thinking much about it. It felt complicated to have ignored this housemate on this street. For one thing, I hate assuming the worst of people, assuming that this person who I know and trust and live with was a stranger participating in a form of street harassment. And on the other hand, I know that women's bodies are objectified in the media and by strangers, and women are systematically made to feel unsafe, either by actual violence or by threat of violence, as a way to assert power and intimidation and dominance in public. So why can't we just all recognize that we all want the same thing, deep down, that we are all members of the same human family and treat one another as such? The American Transcendentalists, our great spiritual ancestors, mainly on the Unitarian side, believed in the immanence of the divine, in the personal, immediate, direct experience of the holy. They believed that humans have ideas that do not come from the five senses or direct reasoning, but are instead from direct experience of God's presence in their lives. Not transcendent and remote, but immanent, here and knowable and present with us. Their direct experience of God was centered on individual consciousness rather than external fact passed down as religious truths. This was foundational for much of our Unitarian theology. It was Ralph Waldo Emerson who said that we should dare to love God without mediator or veil, to know God directly. The idea that God was accessible to all through direct experience, that all had a closeness and a similarity to God, was a huge shift in the predominating theology of the day. The problem, of course, is that our individual consciousness and experiences are both profound sources of wisdom and authority, but are also shaped by our social identities, or as the Transcendentalists might have said, by our lot in life. In 1828, William Ellery Channing delivered his sermon, Likeness to God, in which he professed that each person has a likeness to God, which belongs to our spiritual or higher nature. And it has its foundation, Channing believed, in the original and essential capacities of the mind. Channing wrote, "We see God around us because God dwells within us. It is by a kindred wisdom that we discern God's wisdom and God's works." And yet the Transcendentalists, like many thinkers of that era, also employed a kind of mind-body dualism or a mind-body split that separated our animal propensities of the body from our intellectual and moral powers. This separation is a part of a larger theoretical discourse that has been used for centuries to justify laws and cultural practices that viewed women and people of color as more animalistic, more in their bodies and less rational, and to see white people and men as more in their mind, more rational, closer to God, more spiritual. We can still see these damaging theoretical discourses in play today. We can see them in our media and in our laws. And yet the Transcendentalists were also deeply concerned with social reform. They were generally extremely progressive for their era, and they were focused on God dwelling within each individual, not just in one man or a select few. Channing himself had preached almost 10 years earlier about his views on Unitarian Christianity, where he talked about Jesus as fully human rather than Jesus as God. Unitarians eventually splintered from the Trinitarian Congregationalists that we grew out of over this very doctrine, whether Jesus was a child of God or whether Jesus was the child of God. Growing up Unitarian Universalist, I was often told that Jesus was a great man and a great teacher, but not necessarily more so the child of God, more than any and all of us are children of God. And in my learning in seminary, I came to find that this had great historical foundations in our Unitarian history. Yet Jesus' life and ministry were a reminder that we are all incarnations of the holy, that the lepers and the prostitutes and the poor and the hungry and the imprisoned, the least of these, all were part of the kingdom of God. Even if we Unitarian Universalists don't typically consider Jesus to be part of the triune God, I believe that we can understand Jesus to have embodied the divinity and likeness to God that all of us have the potential to embody, as the Transcendentalists believe. And yet we are not just spirits seeking to commune with the divine. We do live in particular bodies. We live in bodies that are treated in different ways, the lepers and the prostitutes, depending on how people read our bodies, depending on the culture and the time that we live in, depending on who has power and who does not. And when our bodies are sick, our spirits can suffer. We can feel like our bodies have betrayed us, our bodies can be broken, they can fight and heal and suffer and connect. And we can't pretend that those embodied experiences are not spiritual experiences. It matters that we are embodied beings because our life experiences are shaped by and based on the interpretations of our bodies and our experiences of living in the bodies that we have been given. We can't separate our spiritual experiences from our embodied experiences, nor can we really deeply know what another person experiences. In our culture, some bodies and the identities they carry are given more rights, privileges, and preferential treatment than others. Women's bodies, fat bodies, older bodies, younger bodies, queer and trans bodies, black and brown bodies, immigrant bodies. Violence, both interpersonally and on behalf of the state, is more likely to be committed against people with certain types of embodied identities: women, people of color, immigrants. We restrict where some people's bodies can go. We limit people's access of movement through borders or prisons or blockades or transportation inequities or limited economic opportunities that restrict where some people can live and work. The bodies that we have each been given have very real consequences on our lives and our spirits. We see so many examples of this week in and week out. Hurricane Katrina disproportionately affected people of color and their access to medical care, food, housing, and movement. Women are more likely to be harassed on the street, sexually assaulted, objectified by the media. We police and lock up disproportionately more black and brown and transgender and queer individuals. We suspect people of color of being dangerous or up to no good. Black and brown men are more likely to be killed by the police and viewed with suspicion. The protests and demonstrations in Ferguson this summer are more likely to be coded as riots and thugs than a peaceful demonstration, while raucous, property-destroying gatherings of drunken partiers in mostly white New Hampshire around Halloween are coded by the media as revelers. Just having a good time. We shame fat bodies, we disallow access to bodies with disabilities. And in each of these bodies is a human spirit, a child of God. My friends, this is sin on a cultural level. And I know we're ambivalent about that word sometimes. But none of us here created these systems, and most of us try to be good to one another despite it all. And yet we have systems that allow this to happen. And this is what Reinhold Niebuhr would call corporate sin, a sin of the whole, of society. And here is where we are called to the work of redemption and grace, the work of helping and healing and creating and loving and connecting and holding one another. And we won't always get it right, but we are called to the work nonetheless. Because we can, in some cases and some times of our lives, use our bodies to help heal the world, to help connect, to help create justice. We can use these bodies that we've been given to rebuild, as our group in New Orleans did this past week, doing the physical labor of repairing the world, because it takes work. We can put our bodies in the street, we can blockade foreclosure evictions, as people in my neighborhood do, and we can blockade coal shipments and immigration detention centers. We can join marches and demonstrations, voting with our feet and showing the number of people who care about a given issue and our collective demand for equality and justice. This summer, right before I began working here, I traveled to Colombia, South America, to visit one of my very dear friends from high school, Gail. Gail had been living and working in Colombia since last November, and she went to Colombia with a group called the Fellowship of Reconciliation Peace Project. Peace Presence, and their mission is to provide physical safety, political visibility, and solidarity by accompanying communities and organizations that embrace active nonviolence to defend their life, land, and dignity. When I visited, Gail was living in a small village called La Union, which means the Union, a part of a rural peace community in the northern part of Colombia in the Andes mountain range. When I went to visit Gail, where she was living, I had to travel via two airplanes from Bogota and a bus, followed by a 45-minute taxi, followed by another 45-minute Jeep ride, followed by the most beautiful and exhausting two-hour hike straight up into the mountains, carrying all of our stuff. This community has been under the threat of violence for a long time from both military and paramilitary groups, over their interest in the specific geographic area where they live, and over the community's commitment to nonviolence and not engaging with the conflict in that region. In the year 2000, the community suffered two massacres at the hands of paramilitaries, one in the town center in which five people were killed, and the other in the when the paramilitaries assassinated six leaders of the peace community in the village of La Union, which is where my friend Gail was living 14 years later. After these massacres, the communities chose to request international accompaniment to live with them in a semi-permanent arrangement. The idea of international accompaniment, which is what my friend Gail has been doing for this past year, essentially demonstrates an international presence in a conflict region. And this can considerably reduce the risks for civilian populations that are currently targets for armed actors. 5 years later, after that first massacre, another massacre happened in a place where there weren't international accompaniers, and the Fellowship of Reconciliation accompaniers went with members of the community to videotape evidence of the massacre, bringing international attention to the incident and international outcry. Personifies the international concern for human rights and is a visible reminder to those who use violence, the armed actors in the region, that their actions won't go unnoticed. This community and those who accompany them are protected under international law, and the accompaniers are there to remind anyone who would commit violence against the community that there will be an international response, usually either diplomatic or economic pressure, and that the perpetrators of violence want to avoid this. This has been proven to be an extremely effective deterrent to violence in those conflict regions. Gail and the other volunteers there are literally using their bodies, their international passports, their statuses that give them unearned privilege and access, to accompany and provide protection to people whose lives and land and communities are under threat of violence. And the use of her body in solidarity with this community is no small thing. In her most recent email to her friends and family at home, Gail wrote about how this past year has changed her. She wrote in particular, "My body is different. After walking so many trails and needing to do some of it fast, my balance, which started out good, is now excellent. I can handle humidity better, and I never want to see a bug again, so help the next sorry suckers that set their sights on me. The scars will fade eventually. and I can sleep in a hammock now. I love that. We each have ways that we can use the specific bodies that we live in to create more justice and equity and peace in the world, to help build a world that reflects our belief that all people, not just some people, are incarnations of the holy and should be treated as such, including ourselves, for our own bodies deserve our love and care and tenderness too. Perhaps showing up looks like a year of international accompaniment, though perhaps not for most people. But perhaps it is giving a week to rebuild a house damaged by a hurricane. Perhaps it is showing up for a friend with a shoulder to cry on, or listening attentively, or cooking meals, or offering rides, or simply your presence. Perhaps it is with civil disobedience, or perhaps it is volunteering with our Partakers program. There are so many ways we can show up. If we believe that we are all spiritually equal, no matter what bodies we were given or grew into, if we believe that we are equally beloved by a love that will not let us go, equally worthy of love, and equally capable of being incarnations of the holy, then we must work to build a world that reflects that. For the world that we live in right now surely does not. As we look toward the season of Advent next month, I know it's a little early, I love to remember that the meaning of the word Emmanuel is God is with us. I love to reflect on the spiritual messages of what it might mean if we interpreted the story of Jesus as a story about incarnation of the holy in each and every human being. May we know that the holy is with us, among us, in each and every person we meet, and in ourselves. Because what would we do if we really, truly believed that were true? What would we do? May we go out and do it. Amen. And blessed be.